Hello, I'm Oliver Wong. Morgan Rhodes is off this week, so I'll be holding the reins solo for this episode of Heat Rocks. Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock that is an album that burns its way into your core. And today, we'll be taking a journey filled with a long series of adventures back to 1983 to talk about Odyssey, the pinnacle album by guitarist James Blood Ulmer. Electric guitar and free jazz may not be terms that folks normally pair together, but when James Blood Ulmer first began collaborating with jazz giant Ornette Coleman in the mid-1970s, Ulmer found an instant kinship in the heady improvisational style of Coleman's harmelotics theory. That influence would shape the beginnings of Ulmer's solo career later in the decade, culminating for many in Odyssey, recorded in 1983 with just Ulmer, drummer Warren Benbow, and violinist Charlie Burnham. Since then, the album is considered one of Ulmer's greatest achievements, what longtime New York music critic Robert Christgau lauded as an Ur-American synthesis that takes in jazz, rock, delta blues, and even country music. You'd be hard-pressed to pin just one style on any of this painfully beautiful stuff. Odyssey was the album pick of our guest today, music historian and author R.J. Smith. I first met R.J. when I moved back to L.A. in 2006, and at the time, he had already authored The Great Black Way, one of the essential histories of the city's once thriving Central Avenue jazz scene, and within a few years, he turned his attention on to James Brown, with the definitive biography, The One. His most recent book, which came out in 2017, was American Witness, The Art and Life of Robert Frank, about the influential but reclusive photographer and documentarian. And right now, RJ's at work on another musical biography, this one of a little old guitarist from St. Louis named Charles Edward Anderson Berry, but you can just call him Chuck. RJ, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Oliver, it's great to be here.
Morgan often says that no matter how much we predict what albums we think our guests are going to pick, we are almost always off in our predictions. And for me, I just figured maybe you would pick something, for example, out of your hometown of Detroit, maybe like an MC5 album, or because you've been working on this Chuck Berry biography, you'd pick something connected with him. What I did not expect would be a free jazz meets electric blues album. Why Odyssey and why Ulmer?
Yeah. Well, this is a record that mattered a lot to me when I heard it back in 83, and it's kind of stuck with me ever since, but I haven't thought about it in a long time, and it needs to be thought about. So I wanted to get under the hood and understand it better than I did, except on a kind of a gut level.
Yeah.
Also, I guess, writing about Chuck Berry, I've been thinking a lot about the fate of the electric guitar and the value of and what's possible on the instrument. And for all those reasons, there's no better figure alive to look at than James Blood Ulmer.
What was your introduction to Ulmer?
I moved to New York from the Midwest about 1981. And I just fell into that general cultural scene, the East Village scene. I lived in Brooklyn. I was going to hear shows every night. And suddenly there he was in front of me. He'd been in front of a lot of other people earlier than that. And once you hear that music, you may not be settled with it, but you don't forget it.
And so we'll talk a little bit later about that New York scene in a moment. But I'm wondering, with Ulmer in particular, so if you moved out in 81, this album came out in 83. So were you already listening to some of his stuff before Odyssey?
I'm sure I was. Of course, Are You Glad to Be in America was
right.
had earlier versions than the one that's on this album. That was a big hit in my community in the early 80s. So there was that. You know, I was reading New York Rocker even before I moved to New York, and he was there in those pages as well. So yeah, he was on my screen.
Yeah. Ulmer is not an obscure figure, especially I think in New York at that time, but it's not like necessarily the kind of release that people would have been waiting in line for, per se. But
yeah.
How were you anticipating Odyssey? And more importantly, when you first heard it, what was your initial impression?
Well, my initial impression was you know, just a barn-sized wow, really. Just what to make of it? You know, we can get back to those initial chords. I want to talk about the beginning of the record, but it's there's no way you can just, it's not background music. That's you know what it is? It demands something of you and expects that you'll give it up freely or otherwise there'll be trouble. Why I was waiting for this record, in a way, you know, there's this interesting moment right then in the early 80s. Columbia Records was putting out these great jazz releases. Mm-hmm. Arthur Blythe, a couple of amazing albums on a major label on which Blood Almer played before he started making his own records, I believe, maybe around the same time. And the fact that an artist like Blood Almer and Arthur Blythe and others were on Columbia on a major label was an investment and a statement about the value of jazz in American culture. And so when an artist like that was presented that way, it demanded some attention.
We will certainly get deeper into the album overall later, but since you brought it up, let's actually just talk about that first listen. And you said, RJ, a moment ago, it was really about just the very, very beginning of the album, which is a song called Church.
Not that I would know, but that is a call to prayer. Mm. It's church. You know, if this is a movie, this is the scene where, you know, the single beam of light lands through the trees or through the ocean to the bottom, hits the ancient temple, and spirits are brought alive, forces of good and forces of the other side. And they are let loose in our lives. You know, even for anarcho-syndicalists like myself, it brings issues of faith into the front of my brain.
Interesting. I hear certainly a little bit, and I hope I'm not being too facile in making this comparison, but you were talking about, it's a call to church, a call to prayer, and it sounds to me a little bit Islamic in terms of, you think about the call to prayer, three times a day. And that I know that the in particular, the violin playing on here, and I think this goes back to that Robert Christgau review I mentioned, he compares a little bit of Burnham's violin work to having kind of a Middle Eastern sound. And I'm wondering if that's also an element that's at play here.
Yeah, no, there's no question. First of all, there's so much ground, I mean, literal geographic ground and historic ground being put on the table in this music, and not in a dogmatic framework, but in a gut comes up as it may kind of way. All those musicians, all three of them, this trio is living in the past, the present, and the future, and they're putting it all together in some kind of visionary mix. As far as Burnham goes, yeah, you know, one thing I think about, We may to some degree think of, you know, the violin, the fiddle, as instruments more associated, say, with country music. But I know, for instance, in the slave era, when drums were outlawed, the fiddle was a way that rhythm was communicated.
Interesting.
And so there's a profound connection there that I think maybe contact is being made with Burnham's playing.
Yeah.
Plus, also, in terms of Burnham, if I can just say, wah-wah pedal. I mean, when do you hear a violin play with a wah-wah pedal?
Yeah.
More, I say, more.
It's also, I think, notable because if you were to expect, I think, normally some other stringed instrument besides, obviously, Ulmer's guitar, you would expect a bass. And certainly, I think, in his previous recordings, especially the ones that were funkier by conventional standards, you had, you know, a bass there. And he makes the decision here to take the bass out and replace it with a fiddle, which I think surprised a lot of folks.
Yeah. Yeah. It completely changes the nature of the sound. It decenters it. There's a lot of empty spaces in this sound, and there's a lot of things you're looking for that you don't get, or that you get in other places. And that's true where, in some ways, I think all three of these musicians are playing with the same script. They're thinking the same basic way about how to make music. They're thinking more essentially sometimes as general musicians rather than masters of the violin, the drum, and the guitar. They're doing similar things, and they're taking turns sounding like one another sometimes.
What do you think Ulmer was doing differently on this album that sets it maybe not far apart from his previous recordings? Because I think people see this as being within his larger body of work in the 1980s, especially in the early 80s. But because Odyssey tends to be put on this pedestal, perhaps above many of his other works, what was he doing differently in this one?
I think he was kind of exhaling here.
Mm.
There was a real, and even here, there's a lot of frenzy sometimes. Not so much here, but still some. On his recorded music up until then, I think the emphasis had been on a real agitated, aggressive, downtown New York sound that connected with the moment and connected for lots of reasons.
Yeah.
And here, he's kind of stepped back a little bit. I think he's got his, metaphorically, his feet in the mud. He's back to South Carolina, maybe a little bit more, where he was born. And there's more blues here, not in a formal way, but in a more general sense. And he's just he's letting all the music breathe more.
Yeah. In fact, let's pull the scope back a little bit to talk about Ulmer in particular. And I went down a small rabbit hole to get a sense of his evolution over time. And the first recording that I think he received credit on playing was back in 1967, and this is when he would have been in his mid-late 20s, and he was recording with organist Hank Marr for a jazz album recorded on Ohio's King Records. I think you can hear certainly a little bit of that fuzz that you hear in his later recordings begins at that time, but it otherwise sounds pretty conventional for what you would expect from a jazz organ album of the mid-late 60s. And then when we kind of move forward to when he joins up with Ornette Coleman 7 years later, there's actually very cool footage of Coleman's group at the time performing live in Rome, and you can see Ulmer on the side, hat on head, face turned down, while Ornette is just wailing a couple of feet away from him. One thing does not necessarily sound like the other.
No.
And RG, I'm wondering from what you know, how did Ulmer and Coleman link up? And really more to the point, how did a guitarist who previously had his grounding in electric blues with a heavy dose of, I think, Hendrix entering in by the early 70s, how does he end up pairing up with one of the premier free jazz innovators of our time?
Yeah, well, you're right, man. Those two pieces of music, you know, people can find connections and they're there, and Ulmer could make them, but there's a lot that does not connect them as well. And it's fascinating to hear those two in that juxtaposition, for sure. Ulmer was living in Columbus, Ohio for a while when he made that record, and then I think he moved to Detroit for a couple of years. Mm. And there's a story, he was playing a club in Detroit, and maybe even on the first night of his stay in there, after the owner of the club had heard him, he said, "Oh man, you can play some guitar. Here's what you got to do. You need to go to New York right now and find Miles Davis. You've got to find Miles Davis and get him to put you in the band because that's where you need to be." And Ulmer said, "Hey, that's a great idea.
Okay.
You got some money?" And the guy gave him money to go to New York.
Wow.
So he gets to New York. He didn't find Miles Davis, but he found Ornette Coleman. So it's 1971. I don't know how, but he hooks up with Ornette Coleman.
Yeah.
Complete different vision of music. Ornette and Miles famously did not get along in different ways. And Yeah, that's another what if he had joined Miles' band, what that would have been like. It totally would make sense.
It would have, because this was already past Bitches Brew. I mean, Miles was already into his electric phase, and you can easily imagine someone like Ulmer fitting in with that.
Oh, in a whole different way, but he would have grown and transformed in a different way. Well, that's a great plot line.
Yeah.
But so he goes with Ornette now, and he moves into, I think it was called Artist House, or the loft that Ornette had, to be a proper Ornette Coleman member of the school of, or that's me saying it, but to really get the full training that Ornette and the experience of being an Ornette musician in that band, you know, you kind of had to live there. You had to breathe the music. You had to listen and absorb the lessons. And it's interesting because Ornette didn't like those tuned instruments. He didn't have a piano in his band except at the beginning and at the end of his career, his life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he didn't tend to go with those kind of tuned instruments, but he would get on Ulmer, you know, play the B flat, play the B flat, play the E flat. He was telling him very specifically what notes to play or what chords to play. And Ulmer had a dream, he says, that he heard a sound. He heard himself playing a guitar in an untuned way.
Mm.
So he woke up. He untuned his guitar to get the sound that he'd heard in his dream, and he came back to practice that day. And Ornette's like, "Wait a minute, play the B flat, play the B flat." And Ulmer says, "Well, no, man. I had this dream, and I can't play it because it's literally not."
Yeah.
So he set his guitar so he could not do what Ornette was giving a hard time to do.
Yeah.
And he used open tuning, and that is a huge part of how his sound changed as well.
Mm. That's fascinating, because one of the things that I had always heard is that Ulmer had started with Ornette Coleman, but when I look through the discographic history, you see him pop up in 74, and they would collaborate later. But it's not like Coleman keeps him around after that initial set of years. And I'm wondering, is that because this detuning was like, Ernest, like, I don't know what to do with you anymore, so I'm going to keep you. You're going to have to go do your own thing. And they found their way to each other later, I think, later in the 80s. But he doesn't continue to record with Coleman through the duration of the latter half of the 70s.
Yeah, that's rich material. And how... You know, that was a period when Ornette was so into playing with people that he felt super comfortable with on all kinds of levels.
Mm.
And sometimes that really literally meant family members, you know, and maybe there was just personality stuff as well. If you weren't taking his orders the way that he, not that he was ordering you, I don't know. But if there was some dissonance that way, maybe he got uncomfortable. But you're right, for somebody who played with him a lot over the years, there's not a lot of recorded, there's almost no recorded music. That's meaningful.
Yeah.
Now, maybe the family has some material that hasn't been released. I suspect there might be so, but but it means something that hasn't come out yet.
And since we're on this topic of just the kind of creative energy that both of them had, and certainly as we've been talking about, you know, Ulmer comes out of this experience with Coleman for, you know, probably the next 10 years plus, is very much suffused in free jazz as an idea, as a philosophy, as a lifestyle, perhaps.
Yeah.
And I think for most people, including diehard jazz fans, free jazz is a very, how could I put it, a deeply contentious style and one that many, including myself, would label as difficult listening. So that's Swingin' Things. That's off of Ulmer's album. What's up with free jazz? And let's come back to talk about Coleman's idea of harmelotics and how does this influence Ulmer in his own musicianship.
Well, that's great. So we'll finish up sometime tomorrow morning, at least with those two questions. But no, those are key. So free jazz. You know what's funny? At the same time that this music is being put out by Columbia, another artist is taking off at Columbia as well, Wynton Marsalis.
Mm.
So clearly, in the label, in New York City, in American culture, two things are diverging.
Right.
Two ideas about jazz, about artists and musicians, maybe, and one prevails.
Right. And to be clear for listeners out here, Wynton Marsalis, you could describe as like the giant of modern traditionalism in a certain way?
Absolutely.
Right.
He is an amazing musician. He's very creative, and he is dogmatic, but he does a lot of different things. And he would, I'm sure, he does play out somewhat free from time to time. I'm sure he thinks he can do it whenever he wants. But he is also very much the voice of tradition, as you say.
Right.
And the voice, he's the jazz cop.
Yes.
Okay? He's the jazz cop who does not like free. He does not like Albert Eiler. He's not comfortable with Ornette Coleman. I'm sure you could see him at a Blood Ulmer show. And he might even like it,
yeah,
but he won't say he likes it. Harmelotics. Yeah, that's the ism, the thing that Ornette came up with to sort of describe, in a general sense, his kind of music, the music that he taught and that he championed and that he lived and breathed.
Mm-hmm.
That has been the most confusing and contentious and mumbo jumbo term for jazz music, probably as long as I've been listening to jazz, for sure. I actually did a story once on Charlie Hayden, the bass player
lived
in L.A. and played with Ornette beginning of the both their careers, really. And he said, I asked him about harmelotics, and he said, you know what, you better call Ornette. So he gave me Ornette's number, and I called him up, and so I tried to ask Ornette Coleman what harmelotics was for the millionth time a writer has asked him that question. And
yeah,
and at the end of the 15-minute description, I had no better sense of it. Although it was a gift and a lesson and everything to hear what Ornette had to say, there was no way I could just boil it down into a piece of writing or for my own sake to understand. But yeah, I would say this. I would say, you know, it's polyphonic. Every instrument playing is in some sense a drum.
Okay.
Every musician is playing rhythm, but it's not typically everyone doing their own thing. They're locked together, and they're playing a melody. They're focusing on a single melody, usually, I say, so that it's rhythmic. Instruments. So all the musicians are having to. That's why they have to live together to do it right, and that's what Charlie Hayden and Ornette did back in the day. That's what Ulmer was doing, you know, in the 70s. It's not something that you can just casually learn. You can maybe play the blues not well or swing music not well, without having to live with your other band members.
It sounds to me, too, that there is perhaps this inherent contradiction, which is its term is free jazz, but there's a lot of discipline that has to go into being able to play it well, right?
Yeah, and I think when we think of free jazz, and maybe when we hear, for instance, a swing of things there, what you hear is the complicated harmony or the lack of harmony. You hear the noise contingent.
Right, right.
You hear the feedback or whatever. Not there's much feedback there, but that's what you hear. And so we kind of, and we've kind of had these assumptions about free jazz being angry or being in your face, noisy, and there's that can be true, but it's often a big mistake to think that way.
Okay, so I think again, if I can represent the conventional music listener, I think my difficulty with trying free jazz on over the years is that partly what I am looking for is melodic hooks. I'm looking for a rhythm that I can nod my head to, and all those things. And what I'm confronted with, to me, does sound like noise. And we could get into a whole discussion of like Jacques Attali and like the notion of what noise is and how it's culturally, you know, specific and all these things. But I think it just feels like what you are trained when you grow up listening to pop music, and the many different genres within it, you're trained to look for particular kinds of musical markers that represent these points of entry to understanding, like, okay, this is how this song unfolds and is structured. And maybe by its very conception, free jazz it eschews most of those things, right? Or many of those things. And so there's not an easy way when you're, again, trained to listen for conventional pop music. it's very hard to figure out where you're supposed to be listening to. So as someone who I think it sounds, you know, has an appreciation for this, what is it that you're listening to when you hear this?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I think there are so many hooks in this music. Mm. And I really think that they're coming at you all the time. And it's not, they're coming from angles and in places in the music where you're not used to hearing them. But there's so many coming all the time, even in that little clip we heard, swinging things. And it's everyone's playing hooks and they're repeating them, but okay. Then they're throwing them out and picking up a new one, or they're picking up the one that the drummer played. And so they're passing them around in this free way, and they're not passing them around on the same part of the measure. Or they're you know, it's like there's 12 bar blues. But then there, which is the most common kind of blues, where right. you feel you know what's coming when in a certain way. But the earlier Delta blues players, you know, if it felt good, you'd throw an extra bar in there. So suddenly you've got a 13th bar, or you'd cut a couple off just because it just felt right. And it does feel right when a master's doing it. When John Lee Hooker is playing the blues, you just feel it. But if you count it out, you realize, wait a minute, we're not where we're supposed to be in this song. And in a way, that's what this is, too. This is just that kind of gut reaction that creative musicians are having to playing the way they want to play.
There's something about it, too, that feels a little bit punk. And if we can come back to New York of the early 1980s. So beginning around 2003, the UK label Soul Jazz Records began to release a series of compilations entitled New York Noise, which focused on a lot of no wave and post-punk bands that were coming out of New York in the late 70s and early 80s. And this included, you know, folks like Liquid Liquid and ESG, Sonic Youth. But by volume three, they included Ulmer's TV Blues, which he recorded on an earlier album, 1980, Are You Glad to Be in America, which, Archer, you had mentioned earlier. And so that is also part of this backstory, too, is where Ulmer fits into what we think of like the downtown New York music scene of this era. You were living there at the time. Where does Ulmer fit into this?
I don't know how much punk Ulmer heard. It was there to be heard. I'm sure he heard some. So, but I would just be more comfortable saying that I think on a instinctive level, on a living on the edge in New York City in the late 70s and 80s, you were part of something. Mm-hmm. And punk was a part of that something too, as was Blood Ulmer. Right. And so this music pushes back at you hard. There's no question.
Yeah.
For different reasons, I'm sure, than the Sex Pistols did or Sonic Youth, but not always different. And definitely, that is a bunch of musicians that we just heard in that clip feeling like, okay, we got this. We know it, and you're going to know it too.
I'm also wondering, thinking about the physical landscape of New York at the time in which where these musicians were physically playing music, how close were these venues to one another, and how many people going to a show in one venue to, let's say, listen to like Sonic Youth or ESG, are they also going to, you know, go a couple blocks across town and then also check out Ulmer playing someplace else?
Man, yeah. Well, that was a time when, you know, for instance, Ulmer was opening for Public Image Limited. He was opening for Captain Beefheart.
Okay.
At the same time, he's playing downtown jazz places. He was opening for non-jazz bands.
Yeah.
He was being played on college radio, WNYU. You know, rappers were opening for Schoolie D was opening for Sonic Youth or something.
Yeah.
So there was this time when in New York and in America, there was this moment when all these connections were being made, and there was no telling from the music. If you closed your eyes, there was no telling where you were standing necessarily.
Mm.
August Darnell could you know, Kid Creole and the Coconuts, could be at a dance club, could be at a new wave club, could be at a punk club if he wanted to be.
Yeah.
And silly us, we thought that was the way things were going to be for good.
With that, we will be back with more of our conversation with author R.J. Smith about James Blood Ulmer's Odyssey after a word from a couple of our Sibling Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
Thanks so much to the over 28,000 members who joined or upgraded during the 2019 Max Fun Drive and to all of our monthly members.
To celebrate hitting our goal this year, we're putting the 2019 Max Fun Drive pins on sale for all $10 and up monthly members.
As in past years, you'll be able to get some pins and support a great cause at the same time. The proceeds from this year's sale will support the National Court-Appointed Special Advocates Association.
National CASA does amazing work for children and youth through a national network of 950 member programs. We are proud to be able to support them.
The pin sale will run from April 29th until May 10th. And if you're a $10 and up monthly member, your personalized code is waiting in your inbox right now. For more details, you can head over to MaximumFun.org/pins.
And once again,
thank you.
Hey everyone, it's John Roderick from the Friendly Fire Podcast, here with Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison.
When was the last time you really liked watching a war film? With Friendly Fire, you get to do it with us!
Yeah, you don't even necessarily have to have seen the movie to get a lot out of an episode of Friendly Fire.
In many cases, we would recommend that you not watch the movie because there are some really, really bad war movies. But a bad war movie makes a great war movie podcast.
And in all cases, we recommend you listen to our show. So subscribe and download to Friendly Fire wherever you get your podcasts.
To the victor, go the spoiler alerts.
And we are back on Heat Rocks, talking about Odyssey, the 1983 album by James Blood Ulmer, with our guest, music historian R.J. Smith. R.J., I thought before we get back to talking about this album in particular, if I can ask you a question about your approach to writing about not just music, but really musical figures. And so as I mentioned during the intro, you wrote, I thought, just an incredible biography of James Brown. You're currently working on a biography of Chuck Berry. And these are all artists of which much has been written in the past. And so when you are sitting down to write, I mean, not just an article, like we're talking an entire book here, what are the set of angles that you begin with in thinking about how do I tell a story that's already been told in many different ways over many different years?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, part of it for me is that I look for what I don't know. Maybe I'm drawn to somebody to some degree because I don't understand the music or decisions they made in their life, say. And I want to look at that because I see that's something really, if it interests me, hopefully it'll interest somebody else or many other people.
Yeah.
It certainly will keep me engaged for the years that it's going to take to follow the project through. With James Brown, well, there's so many things. There's in that music, how does he take it all in? How does he get from, you know, vocal group to soul to funk to the roots of hip hop? And is that the same guy? And what's different about him? With Chuck, you know, maybe it's in part for sure, not maybe. It's how does this amazing person who was so connected with America and so connected with kids and so creative. What this creative guy who invented rock and roll as much as anybody did, how do we look at that and celebrate that and look at the guy who was not a nice man? And, you know, in the age of Me Too, that part of his story, an exploiter, an unpleasant person sometimes to be around, someone who went to prison for things. How do we square those two different yet not different in all people?
Yeah.
That's some of them. And for that matter, with Blood Ulmer, you know, this is music that on a physical level, well, two things happen to me just when I hear it. You know, at first there's something so, it hits me in a way that I don't understand.
Yeah.
I have a profound reaction to it. I love it. It activates a certain set of emotional. I don't know. You know,
it's so visceral, right?
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But it's not like anything I've ever heard. I don't quote unquote get it. And so I can do two things, and I've done them both. And with music throughout my life, you know, run from them afraid or just run from them because I don't trust them. Scott Walker, who just died last night, is another example of that in a funny way. Mm. So you can turn it off because I don't want to know what my visceral reaction means, or I can explore it.
You can run towards it.
There you go.
The other option. Well, running toward, back towards Odyssey here. Yeah. What's the fire track off this album for you?
Yeah. I mean, that fanfare that we talked about really was, it's the point of origin of the whole thing. And for me, that just sets the table that resonates. It just hits the chords that resonate throughout that record for me. It's calling people to the public square. It's demanding something of the listener, and it's saying we're very serious here in a way, not in a highfalutin way, but
right.
There's a lot on the line in this music.
Right. And you're talking about Church, just to be clear to our listeners, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Which is, you know, track A1. So going with, and not every album, some albums, maybe that first track is going to be the best track or the fire track because you have to start off the album in a particular way. And I think as we discussed in the first half of our episode here, you know, you did, I think, a fantastic job in just exploring this idea that it's a call, right? It's a call to the listener. It's a call to communities and whatnot, which does seem like how you would want to start an album out off in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it really is saying, get outside. Whether it's coming to church or come to town square, I just have this profound feeling that he's saying, all different kinds of people, come out and be here with me in this moment.
Yeah. For me, and I'm just going to say straight up, my favorite song off of here is very much the most conventional songs from a pop song craft point of view, which is the penultimate song, Please Tell Her. It's a bluesy ballad. It sounds like something I've heard before, and I'm really just completely showing off just how limited my musical tastes are, perhaps. But, you know, it's got his hook on here is great, you know, his guitar hook. And we haven't really talked about this much. I don't know how much Ulmer had sung on his previous albums, but he certainly is bringing his voice much more on this one, including on this track. And he's got a great voice for a blues song.
Please tell her that I had to go over.
Yeah, there's no question. You're right. And hey, that's a great song. That's, you know, so he doesn't, there's not as many hooks on it or something, and they're coming more at a regular.
It's a little slower.
Yeah, right. but it's not watered down Blood Ulmer. It's that's who he is too. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's some great records that were made decades later that Ulmer made with the guitarist Vernon Reid that are focusing on the blues and spotlighting his voice a lot.
Yeah.
And there's some great stuff in there too. He is a really effective, really good blues singer. And it's cool that he's showing the world that more.
Right.
Please, 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 tell her that I shall return over that Father's Day. Oh,
in terms of my favorite moment is what we just heard, and I don't know what it is about him phrasing, please tell her I shall return, the shall. There's a kind of the formality to it. Not I will return, I shall return. It's very chivalrous in a way.
Yeah.
And when I first was listening to that song for the first time, I had to kind of rewind back to that because I just want to hear him say it again. And for reasons, you know, RG, you were saying earlier about this kind of the visceral ways in which we hear music, we don't necessarily understand what our reaction is about. There's something about the shall that I love. And so this to me is my favorite moment on the album. I'm wondering, do you have a favorite moment off of Odyssey?
Yeah, I mean, to go so early in the record to Little Red House, another blues, and in a way, really connecting, I suppose, with the original blues Red House and Jimi Hendrix's Red House. I love that moment in the record where he has shown us the electrical free side of him, and now he's showing us this is me too. And I just go, wow, this guy is, the blues, past, present, and future right here. Mm. You know what it is? It's when his voice goes, woo, that's the moment for me, man. That's the free in free jazz.
It's the woo.
Yeah.
You certainly also hear, I think, what you were saying earlier, RJ, about just the airiness, the space that's there. And I think especially on a song like this or on Please Tell Her, when the tempo slows down, it really draws your attention to how much space there is between the notes and between the riffs.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, they recorded in this big wood studio, and, you know, he's got that hollow body guitar ringing those chords, and there's a deep sense of space throughout all this music.
Is there a slow burner, a song that maybe you weren't necessarily, wasn't your favorite when you first heard the album back in 83, but over the years has grown to be something that you have a deep appreciation for?
Well, yeah, for me, my slow burner would be Swingin' Things, I think.
Okay.
Because there's a big chunk of it in the middle where it's kind of a two-step. It's a really simple boom-pa, 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 boom-pa. To me, simple, quote-unquote. But is so naked and so, it's so in front of me. And it makes me think of polka or a country music, which I'm sure is there in his intention. Not polka necessarily, but country music.
Right.
And it's just something about it that I just did not connect with when I for a long time.
It's also that it's the last song on the album. It's not necessarily the longest, but I think it clocks in a little bit over 4.5 minutes. And I think for an album that takes you through all of these different twists and turns, it's not like the soft landing that some artists might have for their very final cut. This is sort of like, let me just kind of dump you back into it. And we're going to go out off of this kind of, you know, an up-tempo bang, if you will. I think it's an interesting choice to be the closer.
Yeah, that's true. You're like, you've been to church, you've been to this space that he set out, and then he kicks you out the door and welcome back to your life. Mm-hmm.
Along similar lines, and maybe you've already answered this in different ways, but for someone who is unfamiliar with Ulmer, what is a song off of this album that you would want them to listen to as just an introduction to who he is and what makes Ulmer Ulmer, if you will?
You know what? I would go with Are You Glad to Be in America? I think that says a lot about what's on his mind, whether it's present in the music always or not. You get a sense of who he is somehow from that song, and there's a tunefulness there. There's a lot of different aspects of who he is in that. I'd say.
Just listening to that clip, it brings me back to that thing that Bob Christgau was saying about how this is very much like an American album, because you hear so many traditions intermingling within just, you know, those few seconds that we were listening to, right? You get the blues, you get country, you get jazz, you get a lot of different things all crossing into each other.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a moment when, you know, you could hear that on the radio if you were listening to the right stations, a lot of them, though. You could get it in the club that night. You'd hear it on the street going down to the bodega. And you could get it at Columbia Records or a major label.
Yeah.
So there was this thing going on that was pretty glorious.
I'm trying to imagine that song in a club, though. That's everything else I can roll with you with. I'm trying to think of that as a club jam.
Well, not a club jam, but my kind of club.
Okay. If you had to describe Odyssey in three words, what would you choose?
Now, I thought about this very carefully.
And we prepped you. We don't always prep our guests, but in this case.
Yeah, they took pity on me. And I would say, I will say this, Jean-Michel Basquiat. And I would say that because it strikes me that along with, you know, the 81, 82, 83 era being integral to Ulmer's introduction to America and his coming through, breaking through as an important artist, and somebody else we talked about, Wynton Marsalis, before, this is the era that Basquiat is making what many people would say are his most important or groundbreaking paintings and pieces. And you know, certainly there as well, I think there's an incredibly fascinating mix of rawness and aggression and offhandedness or seeming offhandedness. That's key to get across. Mm-hmm. And deepness and consciousness. And there is so much diasporic history put in the context of pop music or, for Basquiat, pop culture. It just strikes me there's a lot. I don't know who heard who or who might have crossed paths with who in that, but they were in the same place some point.
Right. No, I love that. I think you're the first person to ever choose someone's name to answer that. I think that it totally makes sense, especially in the way that you broke it down. Well, that will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, R.J. Smith. What do you have coming out, if anything, later on this year?
Wow. I am writing a profile for a website called buynwr.com about an artist and an actor, African-American actor, who was from Los Angeles, brother of the drummer Chico Hamilton, an actor by the name of Bernie Hamilton. Mm. So it's a full-length biography of an actor and what he had to deal with to get a very interesting career.
All right. And when's the Chuck Berry book maybe going to be due out?
Yeah.
Dangerous question to ask, I know.
It'll be coming out in 2 years.
Okay. Fair enough. I won't hold you to that because, as speaking as someone who's written a book, we know how flexible, shall we say, those deadlines might be. Where can people find you online?
Where can they find me online? I don't really have a place, so I can't.
Not even a website?
No, I don't have a website. So that's
old school.
That's to my chagrin.
Well, your writing is certainly out there. So if you just search for R.J. Smith, you will find a wealth of stuff. And please do check out the books that he's written in the past, especially the one, The Great Black Way. I still need to take a look at the Robert Frank book. So thank you so much, R.J., for joining us.
Oh,
today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wang, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess, one of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Max Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles. We want to thank all of our 5-star iTunes reviewers, the most recent being Artist on the Half Shell, who calls this one of the best podcasts about music. It delivers a fresh perspective and deep dives into music. Thank you so much for that. And for those of our listeners who have not yet had a chance to leave a review, I know I say this every week, but just to remind you, this is how we build our audience. So if you can just take 30 seconds of your time and go to iTunes and leave us a review, it would mean so much. Thank you so much. One last thing. Here's a teaser for next week's episode, which features the one and only Moby, talking to us about Joy Division's second and final album, Closer.
The other thing with Joy Division, apart from Love Will Tear Us Apart, the song titles bear no relation to the songs themselves. You know, like, and so I had an experience with Peter Hook, who was the bass player in Joy Division.
Yeah.
And he tours with his son playing New Order and Joy Division songs. And so when they're in LA, I show up and I sing Joy Division songs with them.
Wow.
And but he has to have the lyric book, and he also has to have the reminder of, like, what the titles are. He wrote these songs, and he doesn't even know the titles. You know, like, I guess, okay, on this, there's the song Isolation,
yes,
which he actually does say isolation.
Okay.
But for the most part, like, you know, like Atrocity Exhibition, there's no Atrocity Exhibition in the song.